على جال يوسف زهراء، على جال يوسف زهراء، على جال يوسف زهراء.
ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتحدون. الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا والشفيع ذنوبنا، سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين، صاحب العصر والزمان، خليفة الرحمن، إمام الإنس والجان، ولعن الله أعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الذين جاهدوا فينا لنهدينهم سبلنا وإن الله لمع المحسنين. صدق الله العلي العظيم. صلوا على محمد وآل محمد. Shahid and Shahid, the martyr and the witness, has been our ongoing topic. Tonight is lecture number 3. We have been dissecting our topic now for the past 2 nights. Tonight's been the 3rd day, of course. And we've constructed our discussions to talk a little bit about the importance of understanding the mindset, to some degree, of course, of Imam Hussein's martyrdom. And then later on in the week, when we lead up to Arba'een, our responsibility as the witness of that shaheed and what we should do. Before that, with your permission, just a few points about the Sunday school system that we have here in North America, the importance of it, a little bit of encouragement for all of you as well, those of you who are involved in it, and of course a point of the ilm for our kids as well. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. A lot of the concern that all of us have, and the reasons why sometimes we do what we do as elders, is for the betterment of our next generation. A lot of you have told me that everything we do for our kids, Mawlana. We don't do it for our own self. We do it to make sure that 5 years now, but now from now, 10 years from now, there is some sort of a system, a culture, a center, a deen where our kids can benefit from. It's a beautiful thought. It's an amazing sacrifice that our elders have made for us. And part of that process, maybe the most important part of that process, is the ta'leem of that child. It's educating that child when it comes to the deen and when it comes to the principles of the religion as well. I have the utmost respect for those of you who are involved in the madrasa system here. Teachers, administration, principals, curriculum writers, parents who bring their child every single Sunday. It is almost wajib on us that in this day and age, when they spend 30 hours, 40 hours, sometimes a week, in that secular system, we have some sort of system to balance out that system of education, where we are now providing them a spiritual line of education. And I cannot stress enough how important it is that we work on the ta'leem of our children, the education of our children, be it in a once a week school or be it in a everyday full-time Islamic Shia school here in Michigan. There's one already there, that's great. If not, we have 5 in Toronto, we can use 5 more. And here, mashallah, the population is so large of Shias that 1 won't cut it, 2 won't cut it. Sometimes 10, even 15 might do the trick. So I encourage those of you who are Sunday school teachers, who might be 4 or 5 of you, who are tired every single Sunday. You're the same ones who do it for every single year. Sometimes that passion, that intention is lost. Sometimes you drag your feet on Sundays. I ask you to find it inside of you to encourage yourself, push yourself to know that when these children learn something at the age of 5 or 6, later on in their life, they'll use it, they'll benefit from it. We have a beautiful hadith by Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, alayhi salatu wa salam. He says, the one who is taught something at a very young age, it's as if you have carved that ilm in a rock to stay forever. When you teach something new to someone who's a little bit older, it's like writing it in the sand, very easily it'll wash away. So when you are involved, either you are a teacher, or you are a parent of a child, or you are somebody who is doing the administration, you're the principal, you're the vice principal, and you are partly responsible for that knowledge, then you're doing a wonderful service for our children for the next 10 to 15 years. Don't take it lightly. It's not easy, I know, to come here every single Sunday and do what you do. May Allah bless you for it. At the same time, to my children understand that the hadith says, Al-ilmu al-misbah al-aql. Ilm is the lantern of the intellect. Part of the reason why we're not able to control our desires in this society is because our intellect has weakened to the point where our desires control our intellect. And now our shahwa, our ghadab, is now controlling us. Part of the process of educating our kids at this young age is that you strengthen their intellect at the exact same time. To the parents, I just have one simple point for all of you, and I'll move towards our actual discussion, and that is this. The Sunday school system is made to reinforce what you do at home, not replace what you do at home. Dropping your child off here for 3 hours, 4 hours on a Sunday does not replace what you should be doing at home. You and the Sunday school system together are responsible for the educating of your child. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Furthering along our discussion on our topic, understanding a little bit of the philosophy of Imam Hussein, I asked my parents, if you have brought your children here today, make sure they're beside you. The excuse of language is no longer there. I know I'm Canadian, but what I'm speaking is English, inshallah. I still hear some conversations with some kids outside. It's better if they sit here. I know it's tough for them. They've had a long day already, a long morning. To sit through me for 45 minutes might be tough as well. But let's do our best to at least push them and promote them, inshallah, to come. Atul Fashidah. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Are with me, inshallah? Okay. One portion of Imam Hussein's philosophy. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. One portion of Imam Hussein's philosophy is the way that he saw hardships in his life. For us to understand as the shahideen of Imam Hussein's martyrdom, what we should take from this Azim sacrifice, it is how to handle hardships and struggles in our life. Let's examine the philosophy of Islam on hardships. It's a beautiful philosophy. The reality is this. There's not a single person in this room who's free of struggles. There's not a single person in this room who's free of hardships. Yes, there are levels of hardships. What is a hardship for one person might be comfort for another, and we'll look at that very shortly. But to say that this world and this dunya has given you nothing but joy and contentment and peace, I don't think anybody in this room at least could say that. If you are a young child going through school, a young individual going through high school, university, your struggles, your hardships are different. You're asked to make very difficult decisions at the age of 21, 22 that will affect you 10 years from now, 15 years from now. Be it what major to take in school, or be it sometimes to choose a spouse. Be it the fact that you're asked by your parents, by your friends, by your community, by your God, by the alim, to give them your time. And you're pulled 5, 6 different ways. and you can't manage your time properly. And the simple concept of time management is a struggle for you as a young child. When you get married, those of you who are newlyweds in the audience, your struggle, of course, is there. Try to figure out how to make us work. When you have a child, a newborn child within the last year, that struggle is a whole different concept altogether. You forget what it was like to be without a child. You forget how you were, how you lived with your spouse when there were no children. Right? Sleep back then was a luxury you took for granted. The idea of getting up and leaving whenever you wanted was a luxury you took for granted. Now you have to pack the bag and pack the car seat and make sure the diaper is changed and all this kind of stuff is there. As your kids get older, the stuff all of you have is of marriage, education. Malala, he's not studying. Malala, he's 25 years old, has a good job, doesn't want to get married. Malala, he's married, but there's problems in the marriage, Malala. Before, where our generation, our elders were worried about us getting married, now the problem is us staying married. Divorce rates, unfortunately, are skyrocketing in our communities. There is turmoil in our homes, domestic problems. We counsel in Toronto, you wouldn't believe the amount of issues that we see, that weren't there in our generation before us. Whether you are a father in the audience or a grandfather in the audience, the struggle never ends. There's always some sort of stress involved somewhere. And the reality is that we wait for that day. We wait for that day when this world will give us a problem, stress-free life. And that's the problem. That is the problem. This dunya was not meant to give you contentment and sukoon ifminan. I'm not here to create hopelessness inside of you. I'm here to say, instead of waiting for the day where you are free of hardships, let's look at hardships differently. The way Imam Hussein looked at them. I mentioned the very first night, how is it possible this man gave everything he had on the way, on the path of Islam? At the end he says, I am submissive to you, Allah. I am radi with you, Allah. If you asked me to do this 1,000 times, I would have done it 1,000 times easily, Ya Allah. How is it possible if someone like that does that? Let's examine this with 4 different philosophies, time permitting, inshallah. Number one is how we view this dunya. The example I'll give you is very simple. It's an example I've used before. The reality is, and especially for our mothers in the audience, who sometimes they lose sleep over their children. And that's how a mother is just programmed. The dunya has 2 main objectives. You guys aren't with me. I feel like you guys are somewhere else. Are you with me, inshallah? If you can perhaps, Allahumma salli ala, if you can at least come a little bit together, I might feel like you're not scattered. I just feel like you'd rather be everywhere else but here right now. I can tell jokes all day if you want, it's not a problem. But I don't want to do that. Are you with me? If you're with me, inshallah, send me a nice loud salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. I know for my youth, Sunday at 1:30, this is your breakfast time. Just stay with me, inshallah. Within an hour, you'll be farik from me, inshallah. The dunya has 2 main components behind it. Follow me. Number one is imtihan, test, azmayish. Number 2 is distraction. Nothing else. If you can take this from this lesson tonight, that you are to get through this test and maintain your iman in this world of distraction, in this world of smartphones, in this world of selfies, in this world of social media, in this world of this idea that you are everything to yourself, this narcissistic society that does nothing but promote you as the individual, distracts you from your main purpose. How can you be a slave of Allah when you worship yourself? How can you bow down to a bigger creator when you're too busy taking a picture of yourself? The biggest attraction they have driving now are selfies. You hear that? Used to be texting, used to be phone calling. Forget all that. The selfie now is the single biggest distraction out there. You're driving to Zainabia. You're taking a picture of yourself driving to Zainabia. And then you Instagram it, driving to Zainabia. And then you wait for a comment. Like, dislike, good angle, your nose looks small, nice sunglasses, etc., etc. Not one, we'll take 20 selfies. And then we'll pick the best one where we think we look the best. If that process is not narcissistic, I have no idea what is. Let's be careful. This dunya is true, nothing else. Test and distraction. And the problem is this. The example I give you is this. My university students in the audience. My first year university, I remember I had classes which were 500 in size. My psych class was 500 people. I was used to 30, 35 in high school. I jumped to 500. When it was time for the final exam, and please follow me here, the university would choose the biggest hall that they had to host, of course, 500 students. Every campus has a beautiful auditorium. They put loads of money in that auditorium. I want you to imagine a person at first university, his first final, he walks into a beautiful hall. Stadium seating. Smart boards. Perhaps iPads on every single desk. Crown molding on the walls. French windows. Beautiful plush carpet. Marbles on the wall. Follow me for a second. He walks into the hall and for the first half hour of the exam, he's amazed by the hall. He thinks, wow, what an examination hall this is. What a beautiful hall this is. Crown molding, French, look at those doors, look at this carpet, brand new cushion seating. This is incredible. Half an hour into the exam, someone taps him and says, look, you're not here. You're not here to be wowed by the examination hall. You're here to write the exam itself. We are wowed by the examination hall. We don't understand the exam at hand sometimes. Don't be wowed by the hall you write the exam in. Write the exam and move on. This dunya will consume you if you don't see it as distraction and a test. Otherwise, we've seen people, you've seen people, who started off great, pious, muttaqi, believing men and women. A little bit of the dunya comes in front of them, and they're gone. So my brothers and my sisters, understand. This dunya will never give you contentment. Don't expect from it what it can't give you. It wasn't made for the contentment of a mu'min. It wasn't. It is a wasila. It's a bridge. It's a path. It's a tool to be used for the next world. Use it the best way you know how, and move on. Don't sell your soul for it. Don't sell your deen for it. Don't sell your family for it. Number one. Number two. Hardships in this life give meaning to life. I'll give you a very simple example. Sayyid Mutahhari rahmatullah alayh. I ask my youth, sometimes you ask me what books to read. Start with Sayyid Mutahhari's books. They're beautiful books. He touches on the greatest of subjects. He writes to you like he talks to you. In a very simple format. He says that, I want you to imagine that God forbid, you have a heart attack. I'll give myself a heart attack. Let's say I have a heart attack. May Allah keep you solemn and sahih, inshallah. When I get to, I'm happy you're laughing at the fact that I'm having a heart attack. It's very nice of you, thank you. It's only been day number three. I have God knows what will happen after a week. I go to the hospital and the cardiologist says what? The cardiologist puts 1,000 one of those wires on you and connects you to a heart monitor. And he waits for a reading. That reading is one of two. Either you have a line graph that goes like this up and down, or you have a straight line. If you have a straight line, inna lillahi, okay? If it's up and down the graph, it means everything is okay. Your heart is fine. Shahid Mutahhari says, this one small machine is teaching us so much that a flat line is a sign of death. The ups and downs curve on the path is a sign of life. Sometimes we sit there and complain about the fact that why me? We don't understand this is what life is in this world. It's ups, it's downs. What won't kill you will make you stronger. Those of you who have gone through tragedies, those of you who have gone through very difficult situations, if you fought death and you came back, a terminal illness and you came back, you lost a loved one, a father, a brother, a sibling, a spouse, anybody who's close to you, when you're going through it, you can't handle it. Nothing makes sense anymore. You get mad at individuals, upset. How can you live your life? Don't you know I'm in pain? I remember when I lost my father 10 years ago, and I don't mean to keep talking about my father in the last time, I promise. My father comes back from Shabbat Jum'ah, within 10 minutes, he drops. 53 years old, he's gone. I couldn't understand what's going on. For weeks and for months, I couldn't get it. When I went back to work, I remember the first drive from my house to my work. I'm looking around, I think this dunya doesn't stop to understand that my father just died. I was young, didn't understand. Life goes on. People are laughing in the streets as if nothing happened. Now, later on, 10 years from now, when things can kind of make sense to me still, I can now say with complete honesty, the dunya can throw whatever it can at me, it won't faze me. I'm not talking about myself. All of you have gone through your fair share of tragedies. When you're going through it, it's very difficult. When you get through it, at the end, you have a little bit of awareness of what happened, then you realize that now I have this layer of a shield over me that this dunya cannot penetrate. Right? It is my Kevlar. Kevlar, thank you, uncle. Kevlar. Hardships is a sign of life. Number three philosophy. Hardships and struggles are relative. This is very important to understand. Again, we'll give examples. I want you to imagine that there is a farm, a village. In that village, there are two homes. In one village, there is a girl who just got engaged. After a year from now will be her wedding. She's begun the preparations for her wedding. Down the road is a farmer, has a farm, crops. His livelihood, his income is based on his crops. The bride-to-be begins her planning. She brings out her wedding book that she's had since she was 6 years old. And she begins to prepare for the wedding. Everything from the caterer, to the guest list, to the mandi, and the, the manja, and the nanja, and the 8 programs that all of you have for your weddings. You have the decorator, you have the alim, you have everybody. And she wants an outdoor wedding. Ice sculptures, and fondues, and rose petals, and doves, the whole nine. And she plans this for 12 months. The day of her wedding arrives. She jumps out of bed, excited. She's planned everything down to a T. Pulls the curtain open and sees rain. Rain. Heavy, heavy rain. Her ice sculpture is outside. Her fondue is outside. The Batara Alim came on time as well. He's sitting outside as well. The doves now have gone away somewhere far. And she's devastated. Devastated. I planned everything, she said. I didn't plan the weather. Calls her mom. What's going to happen now? Completely, absolutely torn apart. Down the road is the farmer. Has not rained in the village in 6 months. His crops are almost dying. His income is very little. Opens the same curtain and falls into sajda. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. One source of rain. Devastated, completely joyous. Sometimes hardships in our life are relative. We think that what I'm going through is the end all and the be all. Nothing else, nobody else is going through what I have gone through. Not the case. sometimes you have to look at perspective. Right? The very famous statement that they say, I complained, I had no shoes until I met a man who had no feet. It's all relative. It's all relative. And sometimes when we are in the mix of that, we don't quite understand it. Because the reality is that Allah's kingdom works with tests, works with distress. لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي كَبَدْ. We have created the man in the cradle of distress. We put him there. Let's see now what happens. You can say La ilaha illallah all you want when things are glorious. But a little bit of a crack in the sidewalk, a stumble, a trip, a fall, then we test to see your iman or not. There's a story we have sometimes, you know, in the house of Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, please. When we learn Farsi in the first 6 months in the Hausa, they have small little books to teach us Farsi, and they have nice little stories, they have nice lessons. We learn Farsi, we learn a story as well. And we use those stories now in our lectures sometimes to kind of get our point across. A story of an old man, not doing too well, lives by himself. Every single day he goes to the bakery down the road. In Iran, they have a bakery, fresh naan, almost on the corner of every single neighborhood. You go there, you give a few tamans, you get a nice, fresh piece of bread, you put some butter on it, and you have your breakfast. He would go down the road to the bakery, and these guys would feel sorry for him. Say, look here, take a piece of bread and go have some breakfast. This happens many, many times. Until the head of the bakery says, look, I'll give you a few seeds of wheat. Why don't you grow your own wheat, make it into bread, and sell that flour, that bread, back to me. That way you have some income. Great idea. Takes the grains and ties it in a knot inside of his abba, like this. The word gire in Farsi and in English, Urdu, I believe, mean the exact same thing. Gire means knot, correct? In Urdu, it's small, right? Correct. It means gira in Urdu, gire in Farsi. Gire also has another meaning in Farsi as well. It means problems. He takes the seeds, puts them in his abba, ties his gira or gire, walks his way back towards his house, begins to converse with Allah. Oh Allah, help me in my problems. Oh Allah, solve my problems. Oh Allah, relieve me of my gire. Oh Allah, open my gire. Oh Allah, take this gire away from me. Oh Allah, gire this, gire that. He gets to his house, he looks down, he sees his knot has opened. He gets mad. He says, God, I didn't mean this gire. I meant that gire. You don't even know, and he goes off on God. You don't even know the difference between this gire and that gire. He mumbles his way back. What do I do now? He decides to go back and retrace his steps. He finds his seeds, picks them up. They're lying on the ground. It's an envelope with his name on it. Inside is money. Picks it up, falls in the sajda, and says, sorry about that, God. I didn't mean to get upset at you. Sometimes the avenue to our risk are through hardships. Sometimes the avenue to our success is through hardships. Nabi Isa has a beautiful statement. A beautiful statement. He says, you will never achieve what you love until you endure what you hate. It's a beautiful statement. It's a beautiful statement. Sometimes the problem with my generation, I'll take onus on that, my generation, is that we want things given to us on a silver platter. We don't, number one, even appreciate or understand the amount of effort and work that our adults did to prepare buildings like these for us. We don't understand how difficult it must have been for our parents to migrate from the East and come to the West, a brand new country, no language, no culture, no family, maybe a few dollars in their pockets, working 7 days a week, odd jobs, 24 hours a day, night job, whatever they could to make sure that we have food on our table and clothes on our back. And all they want from us is what? to educate ourselves. That's all they want. They would come, many of you tell me the story. You see a brown individual walking down the street, he could be a Sikh or a Hindu, you'll go and you'll hug him. In the 70s, in the 60s, those of you who have been here this long, you can tell me. That effort that they did to not only somehow establish themselves and establish a community at the same time is something that, first of all, our generation should respect and should appreciate for our elders. They were the ones that put these four walls up for us to have even a place to call home for us. Otherwise, I don't know where we'd be right now. That effort did not trickle down onto us, unfortunately. We want things on a silver platter. And that's not the case at all. Because philosophy number four, when it comes to hardships, is one where we say that philosophy nurtures you as a child. It gives you that tarbiyat that you need to be able to fulfill your goals after. I'll give you two examples. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. One example is of Japan. The bombs of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, of course, history is in front of us. The numbers that we have is 70,000, could be even more, that were destroyed on that day with one atomic bomb. The entire country was destroyed. As recent as 45, if I'm not mistaken. That bomb alone gave this country every reason to hold, close up shop, and go on their way. Today, they are the leading, one of the leading countries when it comes to technology, when it comes to the gaming industry, when it comes to many of the things that are right now on our fingertips and on our belt clip right now. Meaning what? They use that difficult time for themselves to nurture themselves and build themselves up very high. The second example, of course, is the Islamic Republic of Iran. A bloody revolution. Thousands upon thousands were killed. 1979 happened. The Inqilab was established. The entire world was in shock that this old man named Khomeini did this from a small room in North Tehran. So they decided, look, these guys must be on their last legs. Let's destroy them. Let's back Saddam, have him attack Iran. There'll be a way. We can once again reestablish our puppet regime inside of Iran. 8 years of a war happened, as many of you know. Backed by the world, Saddam attacks Iran. Halfway through the war, Saddam calls for a ceasefire. And Imam Khomeini says, we're not ready yet for a ceasefire. We will tell you when this war is over. You started it, we'll end it. After 8 years of a bloody war, after a bloody revolution, the year after they lose their leader, Imam Khomeini, can you imagine now? Across 10 years, from 79 to 89, what this country went through. Now for it to be, and I say this with complete certainty, the superpower in the Middle East is nothing short of a miracle, if you ask me. Salaam ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. They never allowed the hardships of their country to destroy them. They used it as a stepping ladder to go up one level. We also have to do the exact same thing. Sometimes this dunya consumes us. Let me give you a very simple example. Including Hijri Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. It's a story often told on the members. I'm sure it's one that you've heard several times. A reminder for you and I. I want you to imagine there's a young boy who's running in the desert from a lion. Very famous story. Running for his life. He sees in the distance a well. There's a well, there's a silver overhang, a rope tied to that overhang, and that rope's going down, halfway down the well. He thinks to himself, if I can get to that well, then I am secure. He jumps inside the well, hold on to the rope, and sways back and forth. The lion now is perched on top of the well. He can't go in, obviously. And the young boy thinks to himself that if I wait long enough, the lion will go away. He'll go chase another boy somewhere. He does in this state one thing that I would never ask any of you to do, and he looks down. When he looks down, he sees the mouth of an alligator wide open, waiting for him. On top is the lion perched, at the bottom is the alligator's mouth open. He again thinks to himself, he's young, right? He's invincible, this gurur of a young individual. I can take this on, it's nothing, I'm untouchable, etc., etc. If I wait long enough, the lion will go away, the alligator will also swim away. Once that thought comes into his head, he hears a sound. It gets better. The sound is of gnawing, ever so slowly chewing. He looks up at the rope, he sees a black mouse and a white mouse on the rope, chewing ever so slowly on the rope. Lion on top, alligator on the bottom. Black mouse, white mouse, chewing on the rope. This bichara badbakht is stuck in the middle, holding on to the rope for dear life. If I asked you rhetorically, don't answer. If I asked you, that answer screamed at me from the audience. If I asked you, what advice would you give this young man? What could you possibly say to him? If I told you every single one of us is in the exact same situation right now, what would you say to me? The lion represents death chasing us. The alligator represents a grave open and waiting for us. The black mouse represents night. The white mouse represents day. Time, ever so slowly chewing at the rope of life. And we are clutching this rope like it is the end all and the be all. The story gets better. I know, right? He says that at the side of the well, it's fresh honey, stuck to the side of the well. If you've seen fresh honey, you know it has a hot smell to it and a hot color to it. This stuff you have is all sugar, it's not honey. He decides to himself now, please follow me, talking to Bimia now. He decides to himself that I've been running from this lion since morning, I'm a little bit hungry. In this state now, crocodile, mice, and lions, he sways himself over to the side of the well and begins to eat the honey off the side of that disgusting wall inside the well. Flies and dirt, everything, and he's going at it. The story says that everything else is represented. The honey is this dunya that we live in, where it distracts you, consumes you, pulls you away from the state that you are in right now. If you were there, you would say, look, Baba, leave the honey alone for a while. Get yourself out of this predicament. I'll take you to Dibra for a nice shawarma, I promise you. Just leave the honey alone for a while. But the honey is so enticing to him that even the dirt around it, the flies around it, the disgusting nature of it, doesn't affect him. All he knows is, look, I'm hungry, I have to have it. Because we live in a world of instant gratification. And Islam believes in a deferred gratification process. This is the biggest problem our youth have today. We live in a society that is instant. And Islam is a religion of the deferred. There was an experiment that I had mentioned a couple years ago in Al-Mahdi called the marshmallow experiment. Have you guys seen this? You seen it? The marshmallow experiment, which is done in Stanford, it actually is an experiment done in the 40s. It's on YouTube. If you Google it, you'll find it. They put a young boy, a 10-year-old, inside of a room, and they put a marshmallow in front of him. And they tell him that I'm going to leave the room, I'm going to come back after 15 minutes. If the marshmallow is still there, I'll give you 2 marshmallows. If the marshmallow is gone, it's gone. You get the marshmallow, that's it. 15 minutes now. You should see this video. It is incredible. The moment they close the door, there's one kid that does this for 15 minutes. One kid starts to pull his hair. One kid goes under the table. One kid paces back and forth. One kid talks to the marshmallow. You know I want you. You know you're delicious. But you have a friend that also, you know, it's incredible. 15 minutes. 15 minutes. And the study said that those children, now how they did this, I have no idea. that those children that waited that crucial 15 minutes for that second marshmallow later on became more successful than those who devoured that marshmallow in 15 seconds. If we can somehow figure out, as young individuals, to remove this need for instant gratification inside of us, and understand that Islam, like everything else, is an investment. It's an investment for the hereafter. We invest our money, we invest our time, we invest our parenting skills, we invest our calories, everything we invest. When it comes to the deen, though, we want something instant. I want to be able to ask for something, and when I open the door, in front of me is the answer to my dua. And yes, we have that in our hadith. You should have that much yaqeen in the answer of your dua. When that musalla is folded up, the answer is already there for you. But if it's there a little bit of a delay, it's not there to cause you any problems. A delayed reward is always better than the instant reward. Always remember that. And Islam wants you to delay that system of gratification. Not always be somebody who's living in the now. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Imam Hussein was able to understand that every step of the way, there was a hardship waiting for me. A struggle waiting for me. And he understood this was the test of my Rabb, of my Creator. This was the way that he would test my iman and my faith. The way that Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad were able to pull the Kufans from that time away from Imam Hussein was that he threatened them with a fear of poverty and a fear of hunger. If you do this, you'll lose your job. I'll make sure you live a miserable life. When those still didn't understand his call, he went to the women of those individuals, the mothers, the daughters, the wives, and sort of explained to the men of your household that if they side with Imam Hussein, their life after today will be miserable. And all of them, many of them, 99% of them, took the bait. Our test as well today is no different. The Sharia has outlines for us. And when it comes to if you are a businessman, there are outlines on how to conduct business. If you are a doctor, there are outlines on what medical field you can go into. If you are a lawyer, there are fields within law that you can and can't go into. More importantly, sometimes, I'll give you a very, very small example. This problem that occurs about shaking a non-mahram's hand, that our youth are going ballistic over. What if I do this, Malana? What if I wear a glove, Malana? What if I do this, Malana? What if I do that, Malana? If you must shake her hand, and they believe that my risk, my job, will not be there until unless I shake this woman's hand. She's the interviewer, and I'm being interviewed. And sometimes the hiring of a candidate is based on the firmness of the handshake. So if I start off the interview by saying I'm sorry, then already the interview is gone. I said, it's okay, Malala, I shake her hand and do tawbah later, but I get the job. That mentality is difficult. Your test is right there on that moment. Because you believe that the signature might be hers on your bi-weekly check, but your razik is somebody else. You'll please this person to upset your razik and believe risk will come your way. The fitna and test of the people of Kufa, the people of Basra, the people of Hijaz, and the people of today. The methodology might change, but the test is still there. We'll be tested with fear and poverty, and hunger and thirst. We'll be tested that, look, I can't hire people with beards, so we'll shave our beards. The scarf that you wear, I'm sorry, it's not part of our policy. It's an amazing job, Malana. It's in my field. There's immense growth. Fortune 500 company, corporate America. If I just loosen a pin or two, is that okay? That's our test. And the one thing the Shaheed that we are here to commemorate did was every step of the way, he first thought about what does Allah want from me? And then he moved forward. Sometimes we need to ask, what does Allah want from me? What is it that Allah wants me to see in this struggle? Because the amount of struggle that we go through, no doubt, is immense. I'm not downplaying anyone's struggle here. There are many of you who are quietly suffering in your homes. There are many of you who don't say anything. There are many of you who brave a beautiful face on the outside, even though you're dying on the inside. But there is no day like that of Aba Abdullah al-Husayn. There is no yom like that of the yom of Aba Abdullah. His struggle one by one was very difficult. But nowhere do we have anywhere in our books where there is a complaint, there's a shikwa, a gila, anything, a shikayat, nothing. The man carries out his mission for what he was meant to be created for. How do we understand that? I'll give you one example in Masa'ib of maybe the most difficult thing that Imam Hussein went through. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. When Amir al-Mu'mineen was given the answer by the Hakim of his time to say, Mawla, the poison from Ibn Muldim's sword has now passed through into your entire body. It's only a matter of moments now that you'll be leaving this world. If I were you, I would give your nasihat and advice to your children. Imam Ali, his kids around him, will tell every single child that this is Hassan, he is the Imam after me. You are to protect him, follow him, obey him, accept him as your Mawla and your Imam. When he was done all of that, the sound of crying could be heard in the corner of the room. When Mawla asks, who is that crying? Ummul Baneen moves forward and says, Mawla, it's Abbas crying. He says, Abbas, come forward. Why do you cry the way that you cry? He says, Baba, you told everybody that they were for Hassan. You gave everyone's hand and you put it inside the hand of Imam Hassan. You didn't call me forward, Baba. Imam Ali, with Hazrat Abbas in front of him, called Hussein forward. Placed the hand of Abbas inside Hussein's hand. He said, everybody else is for Hassan, you Abbas, or for my Hussein. You are to look after him, care for him, protect him. Mawla, there wasn't a moment where your Abbas let you down in his entire life. Yes, there came a time on Asr al-Ashur where Aba Abdullah stood there, looked to his left and looked to his right, and there was nobody there. Called down his valiant warriors. Ya Habib, Ya Muslim, Ya Ono Muhammad, Ya Ali Akbar, you're sleeping and your Mawla is calling you. Why don't you rise from your sleep and answer the call of your Mawla? These are the women of Rasulullah. They need your help. The books tell us that from Furat, the body of Abul Fazl al-Abbas would begin to move on the plains of Karbala. Almost as if to say, Mawla, every single time you called me, Mawla, I came running. But today you're calling me, and I am majboor, Mawla. I have no arms, Mawla. I'm lifeless, Mawla. Accept my apology, Mawla. Abul Fazl al-Abbas, they say one day in the Khaymah, the ninth of Muharram, was sharpening his sword. And Bibi Sakina walked into the tent and saw that the sharper the sword got, the more fierce Abbas's face got. She became worried. Went to Imam Hussein and said, Baba, he's sharpening his sword in there. And he realized, Imam Hussein did, that whenever I wanted to get a point across to Abbas, I would tell him no doubt. But the effect that Zainab would have on him is something else. He says, Zainab, go and explain to Abbas why we are here in Karbala. The sound of Al-Atash was killing Abul Fazl al-Abbas. The sight of Imam Hussein's dry lips was killing Abul Fazl al-Abbas. 33 years old, in the prime of his youth, a giant of a man, a warrior of a man, was there on the day of Ashura and realized, if I was given 2 minutes of the ijazah and permission to fight, this war would have been over. Zainab enters the khaymah and says, Abbas, he gets up, Shahzadi, why does Ahmad? He says, put your sword away. We're not here for that. Fazl Abbas, without any hesitation, put his sword away. Went towards Imam Hussein. He said, if you're not going to let me go to war, at least let me get water for these children. Imam Hussein, after the screaming and the crying of the kids, of Al-Atash, says, fine, Abbas, go out, take the musk and get some water for the children. The only thing I'm going to recite for you is this, that when Abul Fazl fell from the horse, Alama Majlisi narrates, that one day I read the Masaib of Abul Fazl al-Abbas, and in the dream that night, Shahzadi Fatima Zahra came into my dream, said, Majlisi, you read the Masaib of my Abbas, but you didn't read the Masibat of my Abbas. He said, Shahzadi, what didn't I read? I read whatever I knew. She says, no, you read the Masaib, but not the Masibat. He says, Shahzadi, tell me please, what is that Masibat? She says, Majlisi, tell those who are listening to the Masaib of my Abbas, that when somebody falls from a horse, they use their arms to break their fall. My Abbas had no arms to break their fall. He fell on that arrow that Hormuz shot inside the eye. Imam Hussein went towards Abul Fazl, holds his head in his lap. He says, Mawla, I have two wishes for you. One wish is this, that my mother told me that I would never open my eyes when I was born until I saw your face. Right now, there's an arrow in one eye, Mola. There's dirt in the other, Mola. I don't have any arms, Mola. If you can, please, clean out my eyes. Imam Hussein, I don't know how, takes out one arrow from one eye, cleans the dirt from the other. Your second wish, Abbas, he says, please, leave my body right here on the bench of Farad. Do not take that body back to the Khaymah. I don't want Sakina to see this. When Imam Hussein went back to the Khaymah and Bibi Sakina comes running out, she sees the Alam. She does not see the Alamdar. She runs out to the Maidan and says, Ammu Abbas, your Sakina is not thirsty anymore. Your Sakina is not thirsty anymore. So ya'lamu alladhina zalamu ayya munqalibin yanqalibun. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Ma'atim ya Hussein. Ya Hussein. Ya Hussein. Ya Hussein.